Case for today is Seng Chong Ho versus Taflov, number 10-2144.
May it please the court, good morning. My name is Jim Borsch. I represent Seng Chong Ho and Ying Yang Wang in this lawsuit. We are here today because the district court erred in granting the defendant's motion for summary judgment in this case. This case involves a claim of copyright infringement and a number of other claims relating to the plaintiff's expressions expounding a computer simulation model for an artificial system involving two artificial modeling electrons and four modeling electrons' energy levels that mimic certain behaviors of photonic devices. Plaintiff's works were developed under many years of effort and were expressed in a tangible form in texts, equations, and figures. And their complex arrangements were set forth into sentences, paragraphs, subsections, and sections. Defendants' copying of those works destroyed the benefits plaintiffs had hoped to obtain from developing the works. The defendants moved for summary judgment in this case, but did not claim that there was no copying. Despite the fact that there were valid copyright certificates, the defendants claimed that the works were not copyrightable and that Defendant Chang was a co-author of the works. The district court, in its opinion, did not rule on the second issue, but ruled on the first issue that the works were not copyrightable. That decision was in error, we believe. The issue of the works themselves, we believe, were erroneously casted by both the defendants and the district court as being trying to copyright an idea. In this case, the plaintiffs were not trying to copyright an idea. The plaintiffs were copyrighting the expressions of that idea, which were set forth not only in equations and in figures, but also in text. There were many variations of the model that could be used to express the idea. And those variations and the expressions of the idea were copied by the defendants in this case. The defendants argued that the idea merger expression doctrine prevents the copyrightability of the plaintiff's works, and the district court agreed. Contrary to that finding, the merger doctrine does not apply here. There were numerous ways you could express the model. The defendants' expressions...
Well, that's true in any mathematical equation, isn't it? I mean, in high school algebra, we can express a certain relationship or equation in many different ways because we have developed over time symbols, formulas, and the like. But in the end, they all mean the same thing, and all scientists and all mathematicians everywhere would immediately recognize that.
This is not just a case about mathematical equations. The equations were a very small part of the case.
So we can set that aside. What are we talking about?
We're talking about the system that was put forth, the expressions of this model that were set forth in diagrams, in text, and in complex equations.
Well, the model, it only has utility to the extent it accurately mimics nature itself. In other words, we have a very accomplished physicist who is trying to imitate nature, and it's easier to see it and understand it on a computer model than it is to actually go to an accelerator and see what is happening under similar circumstances, correct?
Right.
So to the extent the model varies from nature itself, it has no utility at all. It's a failure.
That's not true. And the test is actually not under copyright law what the utilitarian value is. The copyright law requires only minimal creativity.
Well, that
requires originality.
That's not my question, though. But for the model itself, the only utility that it has is whether it accurately mimics nature itself. In other words, is it accurate? Is that the way that these molecules operate under these conditions?
I think that's important, but it's not the issue here. The issue in this case
I know what the issue is, but is that the first part? Can we agree on that?
I agree with that, yes.
Right. And what you're saying is there is some description of this model that your client thinks is copyrighted. And the larger part of it is not the equations, because we know about equations, but it's the drawings or the graphs?
It's the text, it's the description of it, it's the drawings, it's the graphs. And it is the complex way the equations were put into the expressions. Yes, that's the issue. And in the American Dental case, the court talked about what the defendant's trying to say is this case doesn't belong in court because it involves academia, it involves scholarship. That the American Dental case said that's not the case. That even scholarship papers, as long as they're original, are within the purview of copyright. And here, that's what we have here. We have the expressions of this model that involve text, that involve diagrams, that involve complex equations, that are within the purview of copyright.
Tell me about the text. What kind of text is there?
The text was described...
Is the text different than the equation, I guess? Is
absolutely. Absolutely. And the text is described in the interrogatory answers, which were submitted to the district court. But it does, in very great detail, describe the way this model is expressed. And it describes not only the equations, it describes the assumptions. It does have a lot to do with what the value put into the work by my clients was, is that they were describing this model, and that was important for them in terms of being able to use this model in the expressions of the model in their works. And the district court ignored that. The district court tried to equate this as simply being a case about formulas and mathematical equations, and that certainly was not the case. It was never the case. And the evidence was put before the district court that the text and the diagrams and the equations all had to be considered in terms of the copyrights that were infringed.
When did that come before the court? It seemed to me, reading the record, was the defendants in this case moved for summary judgment, and your side of things was just not forthcoming. Most of this evidence comes on a motion to reconsider, which, of course, the court shouldn't consider.
That's just not true. What happened is that the defendants in their motion did not even attempt to argue with any evidence that there was only one way to express this model. That all came out in the reply brief, and after the court ruled, they tried to justify that. But the evidence was put forth in our response to their statement of facts. We set forth the interrogatory answers, and we submitted the affidavit of Professor Ho that in great detail described the evidence of support of the model. And the district court ignored that. The specific issue with respect to the text was set forth in the interrogatory response that was put before the district court, and there were 33 separate infringed items that were set before the district court. And most of them involved text diagrams, did not involve these mathematical equations. And those were all before the district court. What happened after the fact is the district court came out with a finding that there was only one way to express this model, and that was never set forth by the defendants. The defendants had the burden, if they were going to argue that, to show that. They didn't do that. And we didn't respond in our response because they didn't set forth in their motion. And so what happened was, in our motion to reconsider, we showed the district court that, no, you're wrong. There are more than one way to express the model, and here's the ways you can do it. And that was because that was not an issue put forth in the motion for summary judgment. So the issue in this case is the district court, we believe, erroneously viewed the nature of the work as being an idea. And it wasn't an idea. It was the expression of the idea. And in the American Dental case and other cases we cited, it does show that type of expression, even though if it's about an idea or if it's about a mathematic or a scholarship issue, it is protectable under the copyright law. Copyright law does not foreclose that. And it is, you only need a minimal amount of originality. The court didn't even rule on the issue of originality. It ruled that this was an idea, and that was the nature of the work that was seeking to be protected here. The issue of the other works that were involved in terms of the claims that were involved, we also had other claims that were involved in the case besides the copyright claim. The copyright claim is the main claim, but we also had claims for conversion, misrepresentation, and trade secret violation. We believe those claims were separate and apart from the copyright claim and went beyond the issues of copyright infringement.
What property was taken in the conversion?
One of Professor Hill's notebooks was taken.
And what evidence did you provide the district court in response to the original motion to that effect?
That there was, I think, in Professor Hill's affidavit in terms of that issue.
I've looked at your statement of disputed facts and don't see a claim that there was a notebook physically converted.
I thought that was in there, but I could be incorrect, Your Honor. But I'm not sure they actually moved on that issue or tried to support that there wasn't.
Across the board, and on claims as to which you had the burden of proof. And they certainly raised the issue. Your response was mainly that it was intellectual property, intangible property that had been converted, which is a pretty tough claim to make. In terms of the misrepresentation claim, What evidence is there that the plaintiffs relied on anything that the defendants allegedly told them?
Well, Professor Ho relied upon Defendant Chang telling him that he would not continue on with these works when he left Professor Ho's group.
And in what way did Professor Ho rely upon that?
He didn't take any further action to attempt to, at that point in time, prevent Defendant Chang from doing. He thought he trusted that what he told him was true and that he would not take those works in his new.
So it was a false promise.
Right.
Is that actionable?
Absolutely.
About future conduct?
As long as there's
a promise to do something in the a misrepresentation about something in the future is actionable?
I think as long as you rely upon it, yes.
So Illinois recognizes promissory fraud?
Yes.
And with respect to trade secrets?
That involved the issue of some of the works that were in Professor Ho's notebook were not set forth in Plaintiff Wang's thesis.
Were they set forth in something that the defendants published?
Yes. We pointed that out in our papers.
Which papers?
The summary judgment.
Reconsider or the original response?
I believe it was in the original response, Your Honor. So the issue in this case, the main claim is the copyright claim. We believe the district court did view that claim in an erroneous light, and the defendants had tried to cast that claim in an erroneous light, and therefore we believe that that claim should certainly be reinstated. There are issues of fact in terms of the summary judgment papers. If you look at the fact statements that were set forth, numerous issues that were disputed in terms of what the plaintiffs attempted to or defendants attempted to assert were undisputed facts. Were in fact disputed, and the district court ignored those disputes. This is a case that should go to trial. We believe there are fact issues that have to be decided by the trier of fact here.
Mr. Borsha, let me just raise with you one of my big concerns about this case, which is that if I understand your client's position correctly, it would be much, much more difficult than it has been in the past in academic and scientific work for one person to build on work that has been done and published by someone else. For example, if equations, even diagrams that explain them, are copyrightable, then it becomes much more difficult, for example, even to communicate in the academic world if the person doing the follow-on work has to develop a new way of expressing the same ideas, because everybody, it's like everything, all the work would have to go through a translation.
I think American Dental speaks to that, and that says that's not, the Copyright Act does protect those types of works, even if they are in academia. And what happened here was the defendants didn't just take the works and copy them, but they attributed them to be their own. They published them in publications without any attribution whatsoever to the plaintiffs in this case. So certainly that's one of the problems here is that the defendants not only copied the works but also didn't give any kind of attribution or credit to the plaintiffs who developed the expressions that we're here about today. Save the remaining for my rebuttal, Your Honor. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Borsha. For the defense, Mr. Haas.
Thank you. May it please the Court. Starting with the copyright issue, in the defendant's motion for summary judgment, we argued that the plaintiffs claim protection over a mathematical model of how electrons behave under certain circumstances. Taking the Huang Master's thesis, we showed that after some introductory discussion, the part that the plaintiffs claim was copied is an early six-page section setting forth the mathematical model. We showed that the remaining 30-plus pages of the thesis covers matters that indisputably were not copied, a discussion of simulation results, use of computer code and parameters to run the simulation, a discussion of superradiance and reduced medium method. So contrary to counsel's assertion, we did not say that this entire master's thesis is not copyrightable. We argued that this particular portion that they claimed was copied was not copyrightable.
So your view, the whole question of text is not in question here?
Well, it is. Our view was that the text, contrary to what counsel just said, actually does just say what the equations are. Our view, first and foremost, was that simply just listing the equations and having text that describes the equations does not make for a copyright claim. Now, when we set out that argument and argued that under Section 102B of the Copyright Act that they could not claim protection over that, it became incumbent on them in their response to explain what about the expression was protectable if, in fact, it was. For example, they could have said, as counsel just said, hey, the text doesn't really just say what the equations are. It goes beyond that and says something. But if you look at their response to the motion for summary judgment, you will not see that. Instead, what you'll see is that they argued that the entire model globally was copyrightable because they argued that it was a work of fiction. They argued that it was like Mickey Mouse, and that because this is like Mickey Mouse, we should look at it like a work of fiction and then just eyeball it and see how much looks alike and therefore conclude that there is copyright protection. The district court was absolutely correct in rejecting that argument. They make the conclusionary assertion to the district court that the manner of expression also was protectable, but they never went through and separated out the idea from the expression and showed how the expression part was protectable and also copied. We don't think they could have done that, but we know that they didn't do it before the district court.
Just one question. I want to be sure this is clear in my mind. When you started your argument, you told us that you were distinguishing between the first six parts of the master thesis and the rest of the master thesis. Just explain that real quick and why that's important to us.
Yeah. The master's thesis, there's an early section in the master's thesis, which is kind of the background, which is the discussion of the theoretical mathematical model. And that's about six pages long. And it says, here's the theoretical model that tries to approximate how electrons move under certain circumstances. That's the theory background. Then the rest of the article, which is really the important part, then says, okay, we ran some computer simulations to see if this actually works and how it works, and then they discuss the simulation results. Everyone agrees that the computer code that ran the simulation and the actual simulation results, everyone agrees that was not copied.
Okay, I've got it. Thank you.
So, contrary to what counsel said, we did indeed argue that the idea merged with the expression. We cite the merger doctrine in our motion for summary judgment, and in fact, Judge Bucklow relied on that. Also, contrary to counsel's assertion, we did not argue that the entire work was not copyrightable, nor did the district court. In fact, in the district court's ruling on the motion for reconsideration, she was very specific in saying that she did not conclude that nothing of plaintiff's works were copyrightable, simply that they had failed in their burden to show her that some aspect of it that was protectable was in fact copied.
You understand summary judgment procedure to be once you came forward with your evidence and your argument that as it is, this is not copyrightable, it came then shifted to them to come forward, put up or shut up. How is it? And that they failed to do.
Exactly, and that's exactly what Judge Bucklow said in her ruling. She pointed out in her denial of the motion for reconsideration that the plaintiffs had failed to wheel out all their artillery in response to the motion for a summary judgment, which was their obligation. And if you ever needed a visual description of how true that was, if you look at the attachments to the plaintiff's response to the motion for a summary judgment, it's maybe half an inch thick. Then there's half a banker's box full of paper attached to the motion for reconsideration. And the judge said, I'm not going to look at that because you had all that before. I would add that if we went through that, I still don't think that in the motion for reconsideration that they showed that anything that was legitimately copyrightable was in fact copied. But we don't need to get into that because they didn't bring that to the district court when they needed to. I'll also add that one comment that counsel made, which was when he was asked, you know, the question about the impact of a contrary decision on the scientific community, he complained, well, not only did we list the equations, but we didn't give them attribution. Attribution is absolutely irrelevant to copyright law. And what that statement illustrates is that this is really all about the plaintiffs looking for a fourth bite at the apple on plagiarism, because plagiarism is all about attribution. Under plagiarism, I can copy anything anyone says as long as I give them credit for it. And they fought that battle three times and lost three times, and that's why they're in court. And I submit to you that the court should not be interested in giving them a fourth bite at the apple for the very reasons that I think you've already surmised, which is that the march of science is based upon one scientist building upon what their predecessors did. The scientists today can do things that Newton couldn't have dreamed of doing, not because they're smarter than Newton, but because they've got a lot more to build on. And the barriers that they would be creating are exactly what Section 102B of the Copyright Act is designed to avoid. Moving to the conversion claim, if I may. The mysterious notebook that they referred to, which is talked about a lot in their reply brief, but not talked about much before, it's finally become clear what they're talking about. To the district court, they were talking about intangible conversion rights, and somewhere in their brief, they mentioned vaguely that Chang had issued Ho a notebook, but then they cite their statement of facts, and there's no reference to the notebook in there. Well, it turns out there's some place in an affidavit that they don't cite, that actually where Ho says he issued a notebook to Chang, and Chang didn't return it. And what they say, then if you look at their motion for reconsideration and their initial brief to this court, they say that it was issued to Chang in 2002 to record Chang's work. Then you say, well, if it's for issuing, it's for Chang's work, then why is Ho claiming it's his? In the plaintiff's reply brief, it now becomes clear that what they're actually saying is that Ho gave Chang a blank notebook, but the student then wrote his work on the notebook, and the plaintiffs are saying that belongs to them. I couldn't believe that's what they were saying before because it didn't seem possible they were, but they make that clear in their briefing before the court, because in our response brief on appeal, we said this notebook, which they waived anyway because they didn't properly present it to the district court. They said if it's a notebook that was issued to Chang to record Chang's work, well, then it must have been blank when it was given to Chang because it's for recording Chang's work. Certainly, the plaintiffs nowhere identify any writing of Ho that is on this notebook. And in page 18 of their reply brief, the plaintiffs say, and I quote, "It is irrelevant under conversion who wrote the materials." In other words, they didn't write it. "As Chang was employed by Ho," absolutely false, "and the notebook was to Ho's property. It is common in any company that employees are given notebooks to write official work results on, and both the notebook and the work results belong to the company."
Well, how can there ever be conversion if the plaintiffs gave it to your client in the first place anyway?
True, but it even puts an exclamation point out when you realize that what they're actually saying is that the advisor handed the advisee a blank notebook. Chang was never Ho's employee. They give us no cite to the record for that. They couldn't. None exists. Chang was his advisee. They're saying that when a professor gives his student a blank notebook, the student writes stuff on it, that that belongs to the professor. And that is an indication of the overreaching view that the plaintiffs have of their rights. They never come out and say that, and I'd be interested in rebuttal if counsel disagrees with that summarization of it. But at a minimum, there's no evidence in the record anywhere that any writing on that notebook comes from either plaintiff. So all the writing on the notebook that we're talking about, one, it wasn't presented properly to the district court, but two, none of it's theirs. On the fraud claim, they've been a constant moving target on what they're claiming is fraud. In the complaint, they simply pleaded as fraud against the publisher, that the publisher was deceived because they thought this was Chang Taflov's work and it was really Ho Huang's. We pointed out that that doesn't do it under fraud law. Then they came up with this theory that this promise was made. They don't cite any evidence that promise was made because it never was made. Two, even if it was made, it wouldn't be actionable unless they also had evidence that there was intent at the time of the promise not to keep it, which isn't there. And third, they'd have to have some evidence of detrimental reliance. Now, the detrimental reliance argument that you heard counsel make is the first time we've heard that because it doesn't show up in their papers before the district court. In the district court, plaintiff Ho said, "I relied to my detriment," period. That was the full extent of the allegation of detrimental reliance, which obviously isn't sufficient. Trade secrets, again, they publish the model themselves. So having published the model themselves, clearly it is not a secret. When they vaguely claim, well, there are also some equations buried in that notebook somewhere which we haven't really identified, but that's the secret. Well, that doesn't make it a trade secret anyway. No one's explained why these equations that weren't part of the complete model as they described it would have been a trade secret anyway. I also note that when counsel refers to the interrogatory response with these 33 items, They don't refer to that in their response to the motion for summary judgment. Again, I don't think that response would get them where they need to go, but they didn't present it to the district court. We cited a portion of that to prove that the Taflov book was not at issue, but they didn't cite it that these elements were actually what they were talking about. The Chase Chikwitz claim also fails for the independent reason that there's been no showing of commercial value. The plaintiffs admitted in their deposition that it has no commercial value. The only value that there could be to this work is the value of bragging rights for publication, which is not something that is sufficient to sustain a trade secrets claim, because to be a trade secret, something has to develop its value from its secrets.
Well, the value of keeping it secret is a value protected in itself. The value of when one decides to make it public and when one decides not to make it public. And that can have an economic, a clear economic value.
Well, but to go in that route, they would have to be, even taking that, they would have to show that there was some value to some unspecified equations to being public, and they can't, because they in their own materials describe the Huang master's thesis as the presentation of the complete, and the word complete is their word for a level 2 electron model. So once you've published the complete model, you've got to show them there's some other value. They can't. I'll pause to see if you have any other questions for me. Plus, I can't tell if that right. Thank you for your attention.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Borsha, rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. This case is not about attribution or plagiarism. I was simply responding to Your Honor's question about the impacts of the case, but I wanted to point that issue out. But this is not what this is about. This is about verbatim copying of expressions in protected copyrightable works that were registered with the Copyright Office. Counsel talked about what he said for in summary judgment, and as talked about the half finish. Look at his summary judgment brief, and look at his fact statement, and look at his evidence in support. You will see what he's arguing now, what the district court found, is not in his papers. He had the burden, as a movement for summary judgment, to not just say, this is not protectable. He had to come forward with evidence to show that what we had described for him in discovery, the 33 items that we said that you infringed, were actually not protectable. He didn't do that. And if you look at his fact statement and you look at his evidence, it was not there. Summary judgment does not allow you just to say as a movement, there's no evidence to support the claims. The case law is clear that you have to come forward with evidence to support those claims.
What about Celotex?
Celotex says that it does not shift the burden to the defendant unless the plaintiff meets his initial burden.
The moving party.
Correct. The moving party, and that's why Rule 56 says, as a moving party, you have to submit a statement of facts with evidence cite to the record to support your arguments.
Right, but why isn't enough simply to say the plaintiff simply doesn't have evidence on a key element of the claim?
We cited cases in our reply brief to talk about the fact that's not enough. That does not shift the burden just to say there's no evidence. You, as a moving party, have the initial burden. Now, once you do that, I do agree. Once the moving party comes forth with evidence to say there is no support in the record and cites the evidence in the record to support that, the burden does shift. They didn't do that here. If you look at their fact statement, you will see that the arguments he's making about this being one way to express the idea is not in his fact statement, not in the evidence. And that's why in our response, we did not respond in kind.
Thank you, Mr. Portia.
Thank you, Aaron.
Case is taken under advisement.